You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Gambling, telepathy, and a pesky tumor. It might sound like an unlikely combination, but put it all together and you'll get the plot lines of Jonathan Lethem's latest work of witty, genre-bending fiction. It's about Alexander Bruno, a James Bond-esque traveling gambler who makes his money playing high-stakes backgammon, of all things. A Gambler's Anatomy is published by Doubleday, and it brings Jonathan Lethem back to our show. Hi, Jonathan.
Great to see you again.
Backgammon is one of the world's oldest board games, but does the world of high-stakes backgammon exist?
Well, yeah, it does. There's evidence of it. People can make a living, basically hustling backgammon. It's been known to happen. But I like that it was such a marginal occupation that people would think I'd made it up.
Uh-huh. But is it played in an environment, an atmosphere of women, drugs, and money, as you depict here?
One
did
of
you
the
have
things,
to do research?
No, I didn't do that much research. I picked up a few ideas, but this book is a kind of a fantasia in many ways. I mean, it's set in real cities and is nominally realistic, but the world of this character is really a self-invention. He wants to live in a kind of movie ideal of glamour. You know, he wants to be like a guy who stepped off a Roxy Music album cover in a white tuxedo. And one of the things that strikes me about backgammon is that people associate it with the 70s. You know, you have this image of, you know, two men in the Playboy Mansion with by a fireside with flasks of some amber fluid with an open backgammon case and women draped around. And I think it seems sort of tacky and sort of romantic at the same time. And that's where this guy has dreamed himself. You know, he wants to live there. So he locates that world wherever he can find it.
You said that it's relatively realistic. Bruno is not your average gambler. He has telepathic abilities. That's where the realistic side ends.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that help him a lot more if he were a poker player
well,
than
that's
a backgammon player?
He sort of refuses his telepathic gift. He thinks it's no fair as a gambler, and he doesn't really like looking into other people's minds. So he's arranged his life so that he never has to use his gift. And in fact, I think the reader would have good reason to doubt whether he really has one or not.
Did you start writing this novel with the intention of weaving together different genres, a little bit of fantasy into a relatively realistic novel? Although many people in the reviews say James Bond,
yeah,
even though he's not a spy.
Yeah, it just has that kind of atmosphere, the fake glamour of a James Bond movie. But really, it's a book about character. It's about this guy and his dream life and the way he tries to, live exclusively inside his dream life and the way the world pulls him back out into reality in certain ways. I didn't think so much about genre when I was writing, although by the time I finished, I felt in a way I'd written my first horror movie or horror novel, because it has a little bit of that, you know, feeling of like a late David Cronenberg film with this the surgical stuff and
that scene, that area of the book is kind of hard to read at times.
I hope it's hard to read, but also impossible to put down, of course. It's like an atmosphere of menace, not really horror, but of the uncanny and the disquieting.
This is your 10th work of fiction. Has your approach evolved over the years? Is A Gambler's Anatomy, how different is it in the way you thought about writing a novel to your debut novel or some of the others, the Brooklyn books?
Well, you know, I like to pretend that I'm starting over every time. So the first thing I think is, I've never done this before. This is completely new. It's like I'm a beginner. I'll have to self-invent everything. And then, of course, you set out on a project and you start to, you know, unless you're completely blinkered, you start to say, oh, here I am up to my old tricks. You start to see 10 novels in that you are touching your own baseline material again. You know, there's the missing...
They always say you're writing the same novel, whether you intend to or not.
It happens again. So the missing mother and the ambivalent relationship to Berkeley is very, very much like the ambivalent relationship that my characters often have to New York City, in fact. So, you know, it is and it isn't a departure. There's no question. But by now, I don't fool myself as well as I used to. I can see that I'm up to my old tricks.
You begin by talking about a blot. What's a blot?
In the book, he's got this thing that he at first credits to his own just kind of existential condition. He thinks of it as a kind of hallucination, which is a dark, you know, kind of black, fuzzy spot that's traveling in the center of his field of vision. And because he's a guy who's a kind of a genius of denial, he doesn't go to a doctor and he doesn't tell anyone else about it. He just kind of lives with the blot. And of course, later when the condition that he suffers overtakes him and he begins suffering seizures, it turns out it's very much a physical thing. It's a symptom.
But isn't blot a word used in backgammon as well?
Yes, it's used in backgammon and it's used in Rorschach blot. And I like the multiple connotations. It sort of has a metaphysical feeling of, you know, your apprehension of death might be described as a kind of blot on your life. And so it's all of those things.
And you mentioned that you've devoted a lot of pages to detailing Bruno's tumor removal surgery. What got you interested in that?
Well, I mean, I've been both a willing and an unwilling student of intense medical procedures, craniotomies in particular. So I've read a lot about neurosurgery and found it very fascinating. And the personalities of surgeons have always kind of, well, interested me, drawn me, and also repulsed me in some ways because they're sort of—
Craniotomies?
Craniotomy, so usually brain surgery. In this case, for Bruno, it's they have to go in through the front. His face is basically— got to be opened up. And this is a disgusting and unnerving situation, but I also find it really provocative for fiction because your face is your identity. You know, so what happens if your identity is basically medically taken away from you and then they kind of put it back together, but it's not the same?
Is that where you got the title of your book from, A Gambler's Anatomy?
Yeah, and I liked also that A Gambler's Anatomy sounded like some kind of, you know, maybe secret Bible of the gambler's profession, you know, like A Gambler's Anatomy of procedures. So it has multiple resonances.
My guest is Jonathan Lethem, whose latest novel is A Gambler's Anatomy. After the procedure, Bruno wears a mask to cover his cut-up, formerly handsome face. Can we say that masks are a recurring symbol in this book?
Very much so, and the idea of the surface, the difference between your interior and your exterior, your face or your mask or what's lurking behind it. And, you know, it has an element of the Gothic, I think. You know, I was thinking of movies like Eyes Without a Face and the Rock Hudson movie Seconds, where he gets his face reconstructed and comes out looking like Rock Hudson, or Dark Passage, the Humphrey Bogart movie. And so all of these things are kind of blended into this image.
And what does the mask represent for a character like Alexander Bruno?
Well, he's been, as I say, a kind of a guy who made up a self. He fantasized who he should be, and then he moved into this image or this dream of what his personality would be. And it's kind of made of spare parts. It's like a received personality. I'm tall and I'm handsome. People are interested in me. I can win at this board game. And it was like, that's enough. So then in the middle of his journey, in middle age, he suffers this horrible medical experience, and in a way he's asked to look inside and figure out who he really is. And the question in the way the book raises is it too late for him to introspect?
There are also a number of masked women in the book. Does the mask mean the same thing for them?
Well, you know, again, you know, everyone moves through the world with a kind of costume of self, right? The things that you wear on the outside or advertise about yourself, the face you put on if you wear makeup or you know, the professional disguise you wear if you're like me going around as an author on book tour. And then there's what you really feel yourself to be, which is a much more polymorphous or conditional kind of creature. And so for the women, I think, yes, it is a similar kind of problem.
What about the settings in this book? Berlin, Singapore, Berkeley, San Francisco, all very far from the motherless Brooklyn of previous works.
Yeah. Well, you know, I needed a place for Bruno to be from. And I suppose my first impulse, although I don't even remember crossing it off the list, might have been New York. But then I thought, I'll bring all my New York baggage into the book if I do that. And so I had lived in Berkeley for a good long time, and I had all sorts of interesting mixed up feelings about Berkeley too. I'd never really written about it directly, so it seemed useful in that it aroused some personal material for me, but didn't bring all the kind of Brooklyn legacy.
Well, now you live in Pomona because you're teaching at
Pomona College.
Pomona, in the Disney chair, is it?
I am the holder of the Roy E. Disney 51 chair in creative writing. That's right.
How did that happen? Is that because you also have written about comic book characters?
No, there's no direct relationship to Disney, although it is something ironic for me in that I'm, you know, I've certainly, like a lot of us, I grew up with Disney materials, but I was always very ambivalent about them. They seemed both saccharine to me, and then later they seemed like they were copyright abusers. I pitted myself against them in that period when I was writing about intellectual property. But, you know, now here I have their imprimatur on my forehead. Go figure.
Well, do you feel at home in California? Because so many people in California came there from elsewhere.
Yeah, and it's especially true of a college full of Eastern professors who were lured by this nice environment and this very terrific college. So I have a nice community and an environment there. Of course, I experience a certain kind of dispossession or displacement. I think in a way that's also one of the themes of this book. You know, Bruno is an expatriate. He's a wanderer. And I suppose I've written it in a time in my life when I'm myself a bit of an expatriate.
At one point, you described San Francisco as a futuristic cartoon of the dozy, cozy city. Bruno recalled that the new place was alien. The underside was as gritty as Mumbai.
Yeah. You know, I
San Francisco and Mumbai having similarities?
Well, the homeless encampments under the freeway are pretty desolate there. And, you know, Rebecca Solnit has written very eloquently about the insane, you know, differential between the rich and poor in that city, how it's really an extreme version of what we're all seeing everywhere.
San Francisco is now the most expensive city in the United States.
Yeah.
Bruno is originally from California, and he has vowed never to return, but then he has to.
Yes. And it's a, you know, it's a novel of fate, and of course it also parallels the progress of the pieces on a backgammon board who are destined for home, bound for home.
Have you had similar feelings about leaving home, never wanting to come back?
When I first embarked from Brooklyn, I went first to college in Vermont and then ran away even from there to the West Coast.
And then you hitchhiked from Denver to Berkeley.
Yes, I did. And it was all part of this fantasy life that I was enacting, where I was a kind of like the last standing member of the Beat Generation. I was going to go like Jack Kerouac west and never look back. And of course, he ended up in his mother's house too. So I should have taken my warning from that.
And wound up being a kind of a neo-fascist. So
yeah, well,
Jonathan, I don't
hope
see
I
that.
Can skirt
in you.
That fate.
Should I assume that you're already at work on your next book?
I have ideas. I have some notions, but just assembling the materials now.
You say that you like to write short stories between novels. Are you doing that?
I might squeeze one out. I've got a thing on my laptop desktop that seems like it's turning into a short story. But I'm not writing as many of those as I did at one point.
And what about nonfiction?
Well, I just it's a good time to ask. I just turned in a big profile of the British documentary filmmaker Adam Curtis to the New York Times Magazine. So I'm doing like fact-checking and stuff on that even as we speak.
And meanwhile, we have this novel, A Gambler's Anatomy. It is published by Doubleday. And Jonathan, as always, it's been a great pleasure having you on our show.
Great to see you, Leonard. Thank you.